Well, I've only been in this room for about half a tick, and you've already blessed me immensely. We have had an ugly morning at the Brereton household, let me tell you. So I have 6-year-old twins, Peter and Isabel, and their father, my husband, he left on a 13-month deployment earlier this week. And you might relate to this. My daughter thinks the best way to handle her sadness is to stay in her pajamas and in her bed and to eat as much chocolate as possible. So we had one of those mornings where getting dressed was a huge ordeal. Getting out of bed was a huge ordeal. Me telling her no, she couldn't eat Valentine's Day candy for breakfast was a huge ordeal. Then I drop her off and she's like on the ground. Don't make me go in there. So it was a really sweet reminder for me to come and sing a song about God being a father, because it just helped me just take a deep breath and remember that even though her dad's not here, her dad's here. She's going to be fine, so I'm not going to cry. So thank you for that. That was really important for me today. So today we're going to talk about starry-eyed mothers delighting in who your children are by resisting competitive parenting, which I guess you're still close enough to D.C. I'm a little closer than you are to feel the competitive parenting. It's kind of intense. One of my most precious mentors, when he found out I was agreeing to speak to mothers groups, said to me, "Amy, have you learned nothing from me? You never talk to the parents. You just stick to the research and the teachers, because then you can generalize. Once you start talking to parents, then they're going to be like, no, what you just said falls outside of my child. My child's experience is different." And it's true. Every child is different. So I ask you to be gracious today with some of the information I'm going to give you. It's kind of a merging of my parenting experience, which is specific, and research in the field, which applies broadly, but perhaps not specifically to your context. But I'm hoping some of the general themes that I talk about, you can apply to your world and to your children. Agreed? And I also have to tell you, I don't do everything I tell you you should do. So save myself from the hypocrisy. I gave a talk once, Confessions of a Parent Who Knows Better But Makes Mistakes Anyways. So there's plenty of stuff in here that I'm going to advise you against or advise you towards that I have not succeeded in nailing down in my own parenting. All right, so let's get started. So how many of you want your children to excel? Academically, physically, relationally, spiritually? Who wants that for their kids? Is there anyone here who does not want that for their children? Okay, so we all want that for our children. Let me tell you a little bit about how this talk got started. I gave a talk for some of the parents at our school called Playing Your Way to Harvard. And it wasn't about this topic. It was more about the importance of play. And I had mixed feelings about this title, because on the one hand, I knew that if I put Harvard in there, the parents would come. On the other hand, I felt like I was feeding the very beast I was trying to kill. So they came. We had a ton of parents who came, and then I had to right off the bat say, okay, let's start by just letting Harvard go. Let's just let that go. Ivy hasn't resulted in the hefty income. So I went to an Ivy League school. Cambridge University does tend to rank pretty high on the charts there. In fact, we like to do this to Oxford and say we keep beating you. But it really hasn't resulted in me earning a hefty income. I am an ordained minister, so you can imagine how much I make. It hasn't brought me fame or any kind of world domination. And it's not going to be what people focus on when I'm dead. It's not probably going to feature very heavily in what they have to say about me. And it's not going to probably lead me to have a great quality of life when I do retire. That's going to be more dependent on how I treat my children. So that title about Harvard really implies a very narrow interpretation of success. A very narrow interpretation of success. I would say that I feel successful in my work, but it doesn't fall into lots of money, lots of fame, or lots of power. So, but it did afford me the opportunity to speak truth to this whole idea of my kids going to Harvard. So can we go to the next slide? There we go. So the former admissions staffer at Harvard wrote an article, I don't know if any of you read this, in the Washington Post, but she essentially said, you all got to just let it go. Your kid's not getting into Harvard. Now you're sitting there probably thinking, that is true. Their kids are not getting into Harvard. Please, Amy, help them understand this so they're not disappointed. My kid's getting into Harvard, but their kids are not getting into Harvard. Your kids aren't going to get into Harvard. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, but somebody's kids get into Harvard. Yeah, somebody's kids do get into Harvard, but I think you do yourself a favor if today you can walk out this door, and if you need tissues, I have some. Or we can sing Let It Go together. Your kids, they're probably not going to go to Harvard. My kids are probably not going to go to Harvard. And this from somebody who went to an Ivy League school. The chances of my children going to Harvard, Cambridge, Princeton, are very low. It's probably not going to happen. And if it does happen, it's going to be because God decided that's what's going to happen. And it's not going to be because I pushed them in that direction. So the best thing you can do for this whole Harvard thing is just let it go. So she says instead, we can go to the next slide, to let your kids sleep. Let your kids learn. Let your kids challenge themselves and find the things they want to explore. Define success not by results, such as scores or admission letters, but evidence of their self-motivation and accountability, what they do without parents' pressure. Think about that just for a minute, what they do without parents' pressure. Here's the thing, God has a powerful story for your child. God has a powerful story for your child. It gets messed up when you try to rewrite it. That's why you have to let the Ivy stuff go. God has a powerful story for your child. Think about that for a minute. A very powerful story he has for your child, but you're only going to mess it up if you try to rewrite it to be the story that you want for your children. Let me tell you a little bit about myself and a very good friend of mine who I went to Cambridge with. So I grew up in a Christian home with very loving parents. I was one of six children, and then my four cousins came to live with us, so there were 10 of us. My parents were amazing. I have two, and I'm just like, okay, that's good. And I love kids, but I don't know how they did 10. I just don't. They were fantastic, and my mother always would pray at night for me, "Dear Jesus, please help Amy to come to love the dreams that you have dreamed for her." That was her prayer for me. Help Amy to love the dreams that you have dreamed for her. And I had a rough road academically. I was pretty shy in preschool, and they actually decided that this is a very strange concept to me now as an early childhood educator. I failed nursery school because I would not socially engage. So I am a nursery school failure. Now I kind of view it a very different way, which is no child fails nursery school. Teachers might fail a child, but a child doesn't fail nursery school. The child doesn't fail kindergarten. The adults in that context fail the child. But it was all good because I got to repeat nursery school with a different teacher who was amazing. And she really helped me look at the world differently. She actually, she had her husband build this little house. It was like this little box. And she said, I could stay in that box as long as I wanted to. And when Amy was in the box, or anyone was in the box, it meant that they wanted to be alone. So I spent a good 2 months in the box. And there was a window in the box, so you could see out and see everybody. And she had this puppet that she got out, and I do remember this very clearly. There was a day I wanted to be closer to that puppet, so I came out of the box. Now, she could have been like, "Ah, you came out!" She didn't. She just encouraged two children to scooch over so I could sit down, and it was not a big deal. It was not a huge issue. I sat down, and there began my schooling, and I stopped failing. But then in upper elementary school, things got pretty ugly. I have a verbal processing disorder, which is, at that time was not really diagnosed. So I could read really well, but I was had a hard time writing, and spelling was horrible because I have to picture it to be able to remember it. So when I see Victoria, I actually picture three people to remember her name. That's how so when I first meet someone new, I usually picture a different person with the same name so I can remember their name. But this wasn't something that was really known, so I ended up in special ed, but they thought I had a reading problem, but I didn't have a reading problem. I had an auditory processing problem that nobody knew anything about. But I had a great mom, so she pulled me out for a couple years and homeschooled me, and she didn't really know what was going on, but she could pick up on where I struggled, and she taught me some strategies, and I got back in there, and I did just fine, and then I went and got a PhD. Crazy. My brother said that too one day. He's like, you know, this came out of his mouth before he thought. He's like, I always thought you were kind of the dumb one in the family. He's like, you had such a hard time in school, like a really hard time in school. I was like, did you just hear what you said to me? But I thank God for those opportunities because really what it does is it speaks to the fact that it's God, it's not me. And it would have been very tempting, I think, if I'd always been very good at school to then go on to a prestigious university, get a great degree, and say, you know what? I'm awesome. But I know that I'm not, because even now, you ask me to write a note, I start to sweat a little bit because I'm not sure I'm going to remember how to spell everything. Like, if I have a computer, I'm fine because it spell checks for me. But I actually get nervous when I have to handwrite something. So this is a God stepping into weakness and making himself known sort of a story. Now, I have another friend who came to Cambridge. This guy was incredible. Like, he's super, super brilliant, this man. And we were in Cambridge. What they do is they put your exams up on a building, and like the whole world can see them. So you can go see your marks. So you just kind of go down and you find out what you got. So we went down to see how we did, and I did, you know, okay, probably B level. He looked devastated. And I was like, are you okay? And I thought, like, did he fail? I was like, did you fail? Like, he just looked sick. And he's like, no, I didn't fail. I was like, okay, great! You didn't fail, that's awesome! And then finally, I was like, how bad was it? And he's like, he got two questions wrong. Like, he got a nearly perfect score. He got the best score of the whole group. And I was like, why are you so upset? He goes, I just can't figure out which two I got wrong. And I understood him a little bit more when I met his parents, because they talked about his accomplishments over and over again and how he was great and great and great and great. And I came to realize that it didn't really matter what he did. And he has a great job now. He's got lots of publications. He's a wonderful researcher. He's doing fabulous, a fabulous job. And he's still pretty miserable, kind of wondering why he isn't the next tier up. So it's this constant striving that has been kind of spoken into him, and he is accomplishing incredible things. Like, he is the guy. And yet, there's no peace. There's no satisfaction. There's no contentment, because his whole life, he's been pushed, you're the best, you're the best, you have to be the best. And now that he is, I think, one of the best, he doesn't know how to measure himself against anything else. So I think he's one of those guys who's like, well, okay, I got this, but why am I not president? So I don't, and then he'd probably be like, why am I not the best president? So I just don't think he'll ever have peace, because that's the message that was spoken into him from a young age. My grandmother's favorite quote is one from Mother Teresa. Now, my grandmother had 15 children and then fostered 25. Three of them still live with her because they have severe special needs. She's an incredible, I told her one day, I'm like, be careful, Grandma, you're going to hurt yourself. She's like, you worried I'm going to die? I can't die. Too many people need me. I'm like, the woman's in her late 80s. At some point, she's going to have to slow down, but she hasn't yet. Her favorite quote, and she said this to me in a very, in like kind of like grabbing me when I was graduating from college and like looking me in the eyes, like into my soul. She said, Amy, we can do no great things, only small things with great love. And that's a quote from Mother Teresa. We can do no great things, only small things with great love. And that woman is a testament to doing small things with great love each and every day. I want to show you now, before we move on, a video, just in case I haven't convinced you that this high-pressure stuff is horrible for our kids. It's called The Race to Nowhere. It was in response to the Race to the Top bill. It's not really in response to politics, because this theme has been going on for my entire career, regardless of who's in office. So we're going to watch that. And you seem to be an easy group to convince that this is not good for our kids, but I'm going to let you watch it anyways.
I can't really remember the last time I had a chance to go in the backyard and just run around.
School's just so much pressure that every day I would wake up dreading it.
I'm afraid that our children are going to sue us for stealing their childhoods.
I would spend 6 hours a night on my homework.
You have to get into the top schools.
You have to take tests, interviews.
It's gone way to the extreme.
We're all caught up in it.
In America, if you don't earn a lot of money, something went wrong.
The pressure comes from the colleges, from the parents, from the government, but it has to stop.
You have to do well now so you can get into a good college.
Everyone expects us to be superheroes.
You have a fear from the parents that my kid needs to be able to get a job.
How do you expect us to do well when you can't even make mistakes?
You're dedicating your whole life to your grades.
You have to be smart, and you have to be involved in the arts.
I have soccer practice every day, plus the homework on top of that.
Produce, produce, produce.
It's impossible. I couldn't cope.
I've gone through bouts of depression just because you feel so swamped.
I almost like had an emotional breakdown.
There have been 6 suicides in our school district.
Our students are pressured to perform. They're not necessarily pressured to learn deeply and conceptually.
So what is that going to mean when we have a whole population of dentists and doctors who've been trained from a script?
Things that actually get our students to think are pushed aside.
These kids come to the table with this creativity and this love of learning. Let's just not take it out of them.
I think the United States really needs to rethink how we do schooling. The economic future of the country depends on our addressing this.
We need to redefine success for kids. It's got to be something we do together, all of us as a society, almost as a movement.
Jobs need you to be a critical thinker. They need you to be a problem solver.
We need to really think, what does it take to produce a happy, motivated, creative human being?
So I certainly see this kind of education happening in most schools that I've have the pleasure to be in. And this is something that we as parents do have some control over. We have control over how we approach this message at home. And we also, here's a nonpartisan issue to get involved in. You know, playtime, outdoor playtime is just, it's vanishing so quickly in our schools. And it's so important. I'm going to talk about play a little bit more here. So if your kids aren't in school yet, now's a good time to start pushing on your politicians. So maybe you get a little playtime when they get there. I send letters almost weekly to our school district, encouraging them to consider extending play from 20 minutes a day to closer to 40, which is what we know through research is what our kids need, and our kindergartners need more than that. All right, so let's think for a minute about how we got to this place. We got to this place, so if we can go to the Our Children slide. We got to this place, one of my wonderful, warm colleagues in D.C., so I worked some with Head Start there, and he said to me, he's a beautiful man, and he said, I think we've gotten to this place because we've stopped thinking about our children. I'm like, what? No, I think we're at this place because all we think about is our children. He goes, no, Amy, our children. You're thinking about your children or my children. We've stopped thinking about our children. So it's become a, what is my child going to do? How is my child going to succeed? And you might know, and probably we're all guilty of this, I won't ask you to fess up. I mean, has watching your child succeed at something that other children of the same age struggle with given you just a little bit of, that feels good. My kid's awesome. Look, it's better than everyone else here. That could give you an inkling of kind of where some of our hearts are going here that secretly delights you. Because he was arguing that there is a time in his community where all children were our children, that the children in front of you were our children, that it wasn't about my child succeeding over your child, it was, are our children going to do well? Are our children going to be good neighbors? Are our children going to be good workers? Are our children going to take care of us when we're older? Are our children going to be good citizens and good human beings? And it's become more about my child and my child succeeding. And I hear this a lot because as the senior director of the Child Development Center at Columbia, we've really taken on an inclusive model, which means we have children with us who would have been excluded from other schools, often because of behavior. And these are preschoolers. And I have parents who come to me and say things like, well, it's okay being inclusive, but that child's getting in the way of my child's learning. Now, first of all, I can give you a ton of research to say that actually isn't the truth, that in inclusive classrooms, all children learn better. And think about it, you're learning how to work with different kinds of people. But that message is pretty prevalent of, well, it's okay to have children with special needs in our classroom as long as it doesn't have a negative impact on whose kid? My kid. But if you're thinking our children, then you might ask the question, how does this group of learners move forward together and do amazing things? Because the reality is none of our children are going to do things in isolation. There's not a whole lot of work out there that involves being isolated the entire time. I mean, at a minimum, you're producing some kind of product that others are going to consume, right? Even if you're an artist who spends all of your day inside alone, what do you do with that art? Who does it need to speak to? So this notion of my child, this isolation idea, is not good for our children. And I know it's hard to get around that the teacher might have to spend some time redirecting a child who's having behavior issues or helping a child who's having a hard time identifying letters or colors or something like that. But what is that teacher modeling for your child? character, how to be patient, how to work in a group. So your child actually is learning some really important skills, and I would argue more important skills than the alphabet, because if I had more time, I'd explain to you that in preschool, the alphabet is not the most, is really not a very helpful topic of learning. It's kind of like building the pyramid upside down. I'm going to teach you what these random letters are, but you don't really understand what reading is yet. You haven't read enough stories. You haven't experienced enough story making and storytelling and dramatic play to really understand this. You don't know enough vocabulary and words, but I'm going to push on you, little two-year-old, the alphabet. So I could go on that tangent, too, if we had time. Because that's not good for our kids either. So thinking about our children rather than my child. So we need to ask ourselves in these moments when we're measuring our children against other children and feeling pleased or distressed, what are we doing to our children? And also ask, what are we doing to each other? Because I know that I'm tempted sometimes when I see a child and a parent struggling with something that my child and I do really well to feel very proud of our success, mine and my kids, and to maybe want to let the other person know that we got that under control. That's not helpful for our moms, the moms around us at all. And I also ask you to consider, if you're a Christian, how are we distorting Christ's image? And this is what I throw at our parents who are Christians at our center. We have a mix of strong Christian families and those who are not. And one of the mothers who I had a good relationship with took this pretty well when I said, I know your daughter is brilliant. She's very smart. And she is going to have to learn to be patient and wait for others academically. But I do ask you to consider what model we give of Christ if we do anything else. Jesus was pretty clear in the Bible about who he accepts and who he went to. We think of the blind man, we think of all the beggars, we think of the people who were broken and hurting, and these were the people that his heart was drawn to, those broken people. So we have an opportunity with this our children approach for our children to see what that looks like. My daughter, I had a conversation with her yesterday because there was this little one-year-old boy who was there with his brother, and my two children were playing, and the three of them were the same age, and he was littler, and this little guy kept getting into their play, like he was in it. And she started to get annoyed. She doesn't have a lot of practice with this. And I just had to remind her, I said, sweetheart, what is our job when someone's littler than us? She took a deep breath, she said, to look after them. I said, that's right. Whenever somebody is littler, our job is to look after them and to help them. She said, but I just want to play. I said, I know, but that's not your job right now. Your job is to be thinking of the one who's littler than you. Now, I can do that to my kids because they don't have to do that very often. I know if you have a family and you've got older children, you might at sometimes want to give them a chance to do things with, move at their pace. But I think it's an important message to give our children, which is, and it's not just littler in stature. It's any time there's somebody who's struggling or who is, I don't like to use the word weaker, but who is growing in an area where we have a strength, our job is to look after them, to protect their heart, and to encourage them. So what are we doing to Christ's image when we get involved in this competitive parenting? We're totally distorting it, and we are really betraying a very unattractive face of God's people and God's church. So what should we do? Because I am totally willing to accept there are women in this room whose God has shielded your spirit, and you don't feel susceptible to this, but I can tell you I'm not one of them. I sometimes am tempted to get into this competitive parenting and to think, how can I help my child, you know, excel, not just excel as in do their best, but be the best. Like, how can I help my kid be the best? I know this because I got their performance reports, their progress reports yesterday, and we did okay. But I did ask myself, I wonder how everyone else did. I wonder what so-and-so got on this stuff. And I'm like, what am I doing? Not important. That's not what this is all about. So, I mean, I have to confess that I have to fight this too. And I do believe 100% it's horrible for them. And it's horrible for me. And it's horrible for all of us. So what are we going to do instead? We can go to the next slide. We're going to do some P's. So if you want to take notes, these were some things to take notes about. The first thing I argue that we need to do as moms who do not, is there anyone here who wants to be a competitive parent? You probably won't raise your hand. Okay, never mind. I'm going to move forward on the assumption that we all want to shed this burden of competitive parenting and find a different way. So here are some things that we can do. I would say one thing you can do is you can play. Play with your child. Not flashcards, not learning games, not those I hate those games in the store that are like, makes your child smarter. I was like, oh, please. Playing in the mud makes your child smarter. This game is not going to do all that much. So I'm not talking about those kinds of games. I'm just talking good, wholesome, laughing play. Let me read you this quote by Vivian Paley. She's a great early childhood researcher and practitioner. She says, the key is curiosity. And it is curiosity, not answers, that we model. As we seek to know more about a child, we demonstrate the acts of observing, listening, questioning, and wondering. When we are curious about a child's words and our responses to those words, the child feels respected. The child is respected. What are the ideas I have that are so interesting to the teacher? I must be somebody with good ideas. So let me talk to you a little bit about this. So at our school, we have really let go of the academic curriculum. This is based 100% in what we know to be good research about early learning. Children will learn best through play. They will learn best through lines of inquiry that they choose. So our teachers do put forward what we call proposals, but those proposals, that's like their lesson plan, is done in collaboration with the children. Even our toddlers who don't speak yet, we have techniques that we use so they can try and get an idea of what the children are interested in. So all of the learning that happens at Columbia happens in consultation with the children doing the learning. It kind of looks like this. The teacher will notice, let me give you an example. Last, at the end of summer, as summer was turning into fall, we had lots of crickets in our outdoor classroom. So we have, we call our outdoor spaces outdoor classrooms to kind of help our teachers be mindful of the fact that the learning outside is so important. It's not like we set up learning centers outside, but there's lots that happens out there. In fact, research can tell us that children learn better outside than they do inside. So anything you can do inside, you're going to do better outside. So the more time you get outside is going to be the better for your child. So the children were outside, and they were just marveling at these crickets, and they were catching them, and they were trying to build homes for them. And so this was a flag to the teacher that this was something they were really curious about. So the teacher started pulling materials for them, books like Erica Carle's Cricket, encyclopedias that had information about crickets, started talking about the parts of their body and the legs, how many legs they have. So we're moving in math and science and all of this great stuff, the content that you would want and expect that your child would have. But even more powerful than that, I would argue, so there's language arts coming in as we talk about their homes and we tell stories about crickets, so we're all about crickets. Is the teachers started listening, and we put this on their proposals, is we ask, what is the big question? So what is the big question that children are asking? Because children are always asking questions when they're playing. We're not always aware of it, but they're always asking questions when they're playing. And so the teachers were theorizing, what is their big question? And then they'd go to the children and say to them, I wonder if you're wondering about this related to the crickets. And they were like, no. Well, then it got colder, and the crickets disappeared. And that was the big question. What happened to the crickets? Where did they go? The teachers won't tell the children the answer. The teacher will ask them more questions, put materials in front of them until they come upon an answer themselves. And they had all kinds of great theories about where these crickets went. They went on vacation. Some thought they were hibernating. Some thought they got eaten by a great big lizard in the night. And so they went ahead and researched these theories and decided which one might be most plausible. And right now they're in a waiting place. They're waiting to see if the crickets come back. And they're wondering if they're going to be the same size or if they're smaller, because one child thinks that they all die, that they lay their eggs, and they all die, and then the eggs will hatch, and so all we'll have is little crickets to replace them. So the theories are really good theories. These are really good ideas these children have about what's happening with these crickets, and they're based on the research that they've done in other areas. Another a great example of children having meaningful play, even though we don't see it. And if you've been at one of my talks, you probably heard this before because it's one of my favorite stories. My first year of teaching, I had a little boy named Joseph. He was three and a half. And we were talking about bears. They were very interested in bears. It was the Pacific Northwest. There's lots of grizzly bears and stuff up there. So we were all about the bears. But we were talking about polar bears in particular because it was winter. And this little boy was looking at the paint choices. Now for three-year-olds, we don't want to put a ton of paint out. It's not helpful for them. So we're not diminishing their choices. We're just trying to help them not be overwhelmed. So we had a few colors out that we thought would be relevant for bears. And he said, oh, Teacher Amy, I need the white paint. I said, oh, of course you do. Polar bears, of course you need a white paint. Would you like me to get you a black piece of paper? No. Oh, well, remember, try it, Joseph, but you'll see. You don't see the white. I just need the white paint. Okay, here's the white paint. So he paints the white onto the white paper, and you can't see anything. And then he says, Teacher Amy, now I need the red. Red? Okay, we're going to have a red bear. Sure. All right, so I get down the red, and he puts the red everywhere. Then he says, now I need the yellow. Okay. Puts the yellow all over it. He goes, now I need some black. I'm like, okay, now we're looking like a bear. Put some black in it. He says, and now I need the white again. All right. So there's this giant thing that looks like diarrhea. And I said, oh, Joseph, tell me about your painting. So the good job thing, we can talk about that at another time. Avoid saying that because that just shuts down the conversation and maybe they don't think it was a good job. It can feel disingenuous. And sometimes we say good job, we really mean go away now. So I said, tell me about your picture. He says, well, teacher Amy, first I painted the bones. Then I painted the blood, then the skin. And then polar bears have a little bit of dark at the end of their fur. So I put black for the follicles. And then I did white. And I just kind of stared at this child. And it was a huge lesson for me. Children's play is not random. Children's play is often intentional. Even those two-year-old boys who are obsessed with the trucks, we've got a lot of research that shows actually what they're obsessed with is the movement and the idea of circles, wheels, and moving. And that this schema is very interesting to them when they're that age. And it does tend to be boys more than girls. And men, in general, their brains are more attracted to movement than women's are. So not the case for every man, but generally males are more attracted to movement than women are. So there's reason behind their lines of inquiry. And so what we do when we dictate what they're going to learn and we dictate too hard in the curriculum in schools or dictate too hard at home thinking, you know, I get you ready for kindergarten, so we're going to learn your numbers, we're going to learn your letters, we're going to learn your shapes. I'm going to argue that that's stuff that they're supposed to learn in kindergarten, so don't feel the pressure to do it. And if you just play with them and give a lot of language, they're going to hear those words. You can do it in the context of setting the table. How many people are in our family? How many plates do we need? That's one-to-one correspondence. That's a huge mathematical concept that they're going to get. You can talk about shapes as you walk through your day. You don't have to create and fabricate teaching moments for this content. It's just going to permeate their play. So avoid this competitive parenting culture by just playing with your child and being ready to marvel in how wonderful they are. Because they are going to learn all kinds of things through their play, and you're going to learn all kinds of things in playing with them. And I have some moms who are like, you know, I get bored playing with my kid. No! Kids' play is always fun. Of course you get bored sometimes playing with your kid. And you don't have to play with them all the time. Think about the things that they like to do that you also like to do. My kids and I played hide-and-seek the other day because Izzy again was on the floor like, Daddy's gonna die. I was like, let's just play some hide-and-seek here, people. And pulled her out of it, and we had the best time playing hide-and-seek. We played it for about an hour, and you know how, do you remember how much fun hide-and-seek is? I'm like sitting there, my son's like breathing down my neck, he doesn't see me yet, I jump out and say boo, and he just about pees himself, it was awesome. You should play with your kids, but you gotta find the things that you enjoy playing with them, and part of it is you just have to let the laundry sit. You have to be okay with that, and you have to be okay leaving the mess, and you have to be okay with the Cheerios. I had a great, great professor in Cambridge who came to visit me after the babies were born. She came. I was a research fellow then there at the time, and she comes over, and I was so embarrassed because it was disgusting. And I'm like trying to clean everything up. She goes, Amy, don't worry about it. You know, at my house, you can eat off the floor. I'm like, thanks. And she goes, no, you can. There's enough down there for everyone. I love you. So you just got to let some of that stuff go and just play. So just play with them. And I'm asking you just to trust that in their play, they're going to learn a lot of things. They're going to learn more than they would. And we've got parents who are coming back this year who did not trust us when we shifted our philosophy approach over at Columbia. And they're in my children's class. And so now they're in kindergarten. And they're coming back and they're like, my kid's testing in the first grade or the second grade. I'm shocked. I'm like, why are you shocked? Your child's brilliant. And they'll be like, well, all they did here was play. I know. I wonder what those kids who did not play or how they're doing. And I don't say that in a competitive way. I say that because it's just true. If your kids do not play, their learning potential and their growth potential is going to be less. So step one, do not be persuaded to come down on them at their tiny little ages and pull them away from play. They need to be playing. And they need to play a lot all the way through elementary school. The second thing is, so if we can go to the next one. The little boy, there we go, is patience. This one's really hard, and I fail at it all the time. Be patient with your child's development and growth. Two-year-olds, their job is to empty things and fill them back up again, usually not with the thing that goes in there. That's just what their brain needs to do. They're learning about volume. They're learning fine motor skills. They're doing great work cognitively. They're making a horrible mess of your house. and in some cases endangering their life. So, but that's what two-year-olds do. That's what two-year-olds do. Six-year-olds, I'm finding, really like to talk about farts and butts and all kinds of boogers and gross things. Apparently, that's what six-year-olds do. Try and do it in the right company. But embrace your child's developmental stage. So you may, because friends and people around you want their kids to be prodigies, and let me tell you right now, those gifted and talented and prodigy kids have an overwhelmingly high rate for depression. So don't wish that for your child. Don't wish that your child will be gifted and talented, and because they are gifted and talented, right? But it can be a really lonely place for those kids who cognitively are well beyond their peers, but emotionally are right where their peers are. It's hard for them, and it's difficult for them, and they put their value and worth in their performance, not in other things, and it's just very difficult existence. So let your two-year-olds be two. Let your one-year-olds be one, which means your floor, your carpet has no hope. That's just going to be gross. So don't just accept it. It's going to be disgusting. And then your three-year-old's probably going to have some emotional issues. Like, three-year-olds, it's like, we call them three-nagers. Like, the crying and the, like, I'm made of water. The battle royale. That's a lot of being three, and that can come right into four. So it can feel a little bit emotional. A lot of it is just their bodies growing so fast. It is very much like being a teenager. Their chemistry isn't caught up, so you got to be patient with it. The no phase, be patient with it. And also be patient with them learning at their pace. So we talk a lot at the school about discovery. And this is why the teachers don't give answers. The teacher's job is to scaffold the children's questions and their inquiry, not to tell them the answer. Because when you teach a child something, you take away forever his chance of discovering it himself. Do you ever think of a time when you've discovered something all on your own or mastered something all on your own and how proud you felt? It doesn't feel the same if somebody tells you. It's way cooler if you figure it out on your own. And what's happening there is the children are learning how to have confidence about their ability to solve problems. Another thing we often say at the school is we are not trying to graduate future valedictorians. We're trying to graduate future problem solvers. We're hoping that the children who come through our center end up curing cancer and helping make the world a more peaceful place, helping solve hunger. These big problems are going to be solved by children who see what isn't there yet. We had a little girl who went to the Crayola experience where you color in the picture and then it comes to life. She kept turning it over and coloring the other side. And her mother was getting frustrated. She's like, you have to color this side. She said, no, someone else's work is there. I want to do my own. And I told her mom, I said, that's brilliant. That's beautiful. She wants to come up with what hasn't been thought of yet. That's really powerful. So these kids who take the time to learn how to discover things on their own, these are the kids who are going to solve problems that haven't been solved yet. But you have to be patient because every fiber in your being is going to want to tell them what to do or do it for them. Hold back. Give them time. Be patient. The next P, we can go to the next slide, is to protect. And this is where you need to get a little bit, you know, get your advocacy on. I think you might not have the energy for that, but if you're that kind of person, we could really use your help. I talked about advocating for more recess and play. We worry so much about what a child will become tomorrow, we forget that he is someone today. So we think so much about the future child that we sacrifice the present child for the future child, or we sacrifice the present child for the future adult. Protect your child's childhood. Let them enjoy those sweet moments. Don't keep pushing them on to the next thing. And I know it's tempting, particularly if you have a child in diapers, to be like, I cannot wait for you to use the potty. But they might not be ready for the potty. And the last thing you want, I'm telling you, is battles about eating and pooing, because those don't end well. Those are like a child's emotional armory. They can withhold their bowels and their bladder, and they can refuse to eat. So we can talk later, but don't fight about those things if you can, because those battles, you're not going to win them. Protect their childhood. Protect where they are. Let them play. Get them outside. Get them dirty. Really, really dirty. Really dirty. It's good for them. Because think about it. I had a conversation with a parent the other day because we have an outdoor, like I said, the outdoor classroom. In the outdoor classroom is a mud pit. The kids love it. We tell the parents to dress for success is to dress for a mess. There's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing. We are outside every day. And they're all about it because they want to get in. And then they get in and start living the day-to-day reality of kids who are sending home these bags of muddy clothes. Are like, ah! It's so important, though, because they can't understand Think about when you read. One of my favorite poems talks about laundry on the washing line being frozen because it was out on a cold day. There are kids today who don't know what that would feel like. They can't even imagine that because they're not permitted to go outside if it's too cold. They need to experience what it feels like to be cold. They need to experience that tingling sensation in their fingers. Because we did that, remember? When you're outside and it was so cold that your fingers got numb. There's something about life in that. They need to experience it to understand it. They need to experience mud. They need to experience rain. We go outside in the rain every time. Unless, you know, we got tornadoes coming. But if it's safe, the kids are outside. They experience the rain. We had this beautiful day where the children were spinning their umbrellas and watching the rain come down and then spin back out, which got this whole project going, this physics project going with them on motion. And like that whole idea of the centrifugal force. And so we got to talk about that with four-year-olds because they were outside spinning their umbrellas and playing in the rain. And Europe taught me a lot about this. You know, in Europe, they go outside. They go outside. In Norway, they are outside. We would never go outside. It's dark, it's cold, but they are out there, and these kids do really well, so they need to get out there. And I also believe, as a Christian, no wonder the research keeps showing us these kids do better outside. God made it out there. Of course they do better out there. Of course their brain responds better when they're outside. The rain, God sent that rain. Let them experience it. Let them enjoy it. Doesn't mean you necessarily have to stand out there with them. I'm known to, like, send them out. My neighbor came over, she goes, "Do you know your children are outside in the rain?" I said, "I do." She goes, "Alone?" I was like, "Yes." "Are they okay?" I'm like, "They're six. They're fine." Don't send your two-year-old outside alone. But your four-year-old for periods of time, if you're watching, your five-year-olds, your six-year-olds, they can go outside by themselves. Keep an eye out the window. All right, and finally, we need to pray. Because high-pressure parenting is all about fear. The reason we become competitive and start applying the pressure is we're afraid that somehow our kids are going to be left behind. We're afraid that somehow they're not going to do well, that we will have dropped the ball. We have not pressed them enough. We have not provided the right opportunities. It's going to be a mess, and it's going to be our fault. It's because we're afraid. And God says, "I praise you," or God says that he did not give us a spirit that makes us afraid. He gave us a spirit of power, love, and self-control. And the Bible also says, "I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made." Think about that just for a minute. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. Our children are fearfully and wonderfully made. I think this message is particularly important. I don't know if anyone in here has children with special needs. I do a lot of work with parents of children with special needs. And it's a very hard thing to receive that your child has difficulties. But your child is fearfully and wonderfully made. And I can speak as somebody who has a learning disability that my life would be totally different and much sadder. And I would have much greater temptation to be arrogant if it weren't for God blessing me with a weakness that requires him stepping in to move me forward and to give me confidence. And I feel it as a mother all the time, especially right now with my husband away, just this notion of, "Dear Lord, please make up the difference between who I am and who these kids need, between what I can offer and what they need." Because as we sang this morning, God is a good father, and he will make up the difference. But often that brokenness or that hole is there as a blessing. It's there so that he can step into it. So our children are fearfully and wonderfully made. They're fearfully and wonderfully made if they're struggling. They're fearfully and wonderfully made if they have a hard time making friends. God has made them beautifully, and God has a purpose for them and a plan for them. We have to be willing to dream the dreams that he has dreamt for them. We have to be willing for them to live the story that he has for them. We have to pray to be able to accept this. I can tell you, I don't even know if I have time. I'm going to tell you a story because it was huge for me this year. It was a very hard decision to send our children to public school. In the end, we did, and I won't get into all the reasons why. And my son came home, and he had the hardest time at the beginning. He really did, and I was thinking by the end of September that it wasn't going to work, and I was going to have to pull him and at least send him somewhere else. And he said things like, "It's different than at Columbia. Nobody talks about Jesus here." And he just felt, I could tell that he was feeling alone and he wasn't connecting with his teacher, and it was breaking my heart. But I had felt like God had wanted us to send our kids there, and I respect there are many different good decisions for your kids for education. This is not me lecturing you on sending your kids to public school. It's a decision we felt God wanted us to make. And then one day he comes home and he says, on our walk home, he says, I'm going to write Mrs. Pinkerton a letter. I said, okay, that sounds great. So then I went back to church and did some things. And when I came home, my husband said, you need to see this letter that Peter's written to Mrs. Pinkerton. I was like, okay. I'm like, how long can it be? He's five. So it's in this box, and I open it up, and it's this piece of paper, and it says, trust God. That's all it says. And I'm like, oh, boy. So I wrote her a note, the teacher, an email, and I just said, Peter's written something for you. I hope it doesn't offend you. Please know that it was meant to bless you, and I hope you can receive it. Because I'm sitting here thinking, if this teacher says something to him like, we don't talk about that here, or is not loving it, that's it. It's done. Like, he's going to be dead with this school. He's like, done. Because he was so proud and so pleased, and he couldn't wait to bring it to her. And she writes me back in the middle of the day, and she says, Dear Mrs. Brereton, I received Peter's note. You have no idea what I have been going through. She said, I have been saying, God, if you're there, you need to let me know. She said, I'm having the hardest time with my adult children, and I can do nothing to fix it because they're grown, and I'm just wondering if God is real. And then I get this note from this five-year-old. And she says, you're going to think I sound crazy, but I think it's supernatural. I don't think you're crazy at all. So she and I have had conversations since, and we've been able to, you know, encourage her in her life. But all of this, and I asked Peter, I said, can you tell me why you wanted to write that note to Mrs. Pinkerton? It's such an important message you sent to her. And she said, I'm going to keep it by my bed and read it every night. And he said, I just don't think she knows it's true. And I wanted to tell her. Now, I have to tell you, I was very tempted not to let him send that because I thought it was going to go terribly wrong. But it was this notion of trusting in the dreams that God has for your child and in God's story for your child and remembering your child is not yours. Your child belongs to God. You are just a caretaker for a time. And it was so hard. But God rewarded our family so greatly by us letting go because my husband and I were like, we just saw this train wreck about to happen for our kid, and we wanted to protect him from that. But in letting him be vulnerable and trusting, doing exactly what he said Mrs. Pinker should do, wonderful things have happened. We have a great relationship with his teacher. We've talked outside of school extensively about our faith. It's been really a powerful experience, and all because Peter wanted to tell her that message at five. So you have to be open to the plans that God has for your child and the story that God has for your child. And sometimes you have to be brave enough to let the fear go and let God walk in and do what God has planned to do. So I wonder if you might think a little bit also along those lines about your hopes and dreams for your child and ask yourself, you know, would you be okay if your child became the best plumber ever? I tell you, those people make decent living. Every time they come to my house, I'm thinking, woo! Would you be okay if your child didn't go to college? Like, answer these honestly, because you're probably thinking, I know what the right answer is. But really, would you be okay with that? Would you be okay if your child's greatest accomplishment was something like just being the person who, when everybody saw him or her, they just felt happy inside? But professionally, nothing so to speak of. Like, would that be okay with you? Think about it. And if the answer is no, because I know it's definitely not 100% yes with me, pray. This is where we have to pray. We have to pray and ask God to change our hearts, to help us be the people who can let go and let God work out the plan that he has for our children, to be open to that. Maybe your son or daughter is going to be the best parent ever, but have a hard time making ends meet otherwise. Maybe your son or daughter is going to be somebody who does a fabulous job of sharing God's love with others, but is not passionate about his or her job. Maybe you're going to have a son or daughter who models relationships and marriage in a way that inspires others, and through his or her faithfulness to his or her spouse, saves many, many marriages, but is not a pro football player. God's economy is different than our economy. The things that God has to do are way more important, but not so shiny from our perspective. So I would just encourage you to pray, because I can't give you a magic thing to do to change your heart about this. It's very ingrained in our culture, and the only thing that can help is faithful prayer and asking God to change our hearts and asking God to help us be parents who will submit to his dreams for our children. So finally, how are we going to respond to other parents? Because we're going to leave here today and maybe you're like motivated and you're like, I'm not going to be a high pressure parent. And then you're going to encounter the first playground incident and everyone's talking about how wonderful their children are, how, you know, the 3-year-old's on the 5-year-old soccer team and how they can read at 2 and that's scary. All these great things. And here's what I suggest you do. First of all, I think you should agree with them. You should tell them, because the reason they're making a big fuss over how great their kid is because they're scared. They're terrified. So be a mother who adds value to the lives of others and just tell him, hey, you're doing a great job as a mom. Well done. He's doing so well. She's doing so well. That's a real credit to you. Keep up the good work. Then the argument's done. Like, it just lets it all go. Like, don't engage with the competition. Just agree with them. Bless them. Look for ways to build that parent up because they're probably insecure. I'm not saying be disingenuous, but in the moment when they get it right, tell them, I really loved how you stopped what you were doing just then and went to pay attention to your daughter. Because, you know, sometimes it's hard. You just want to keep talking to your friend instead of pausing and going and talking. Or, you know, I love how you put your phone away when you're with your kids. That's really great. Another topic. What that's doing to social emotional awareness, because children don't see our faces enough. Celebrate the less celebrated, but perhaps more beneficial qualities in children. Think about things like humor. Call these out when your children have them. It is, if you have a child who's funny, you might get some notes home, but it's a really, really, really important skill to have. I wish I had the gift of being hysterically funny, because those people who are funny, everybody wants to be with them, and they can deliver a hard truth in a way that is so gentle. It just gets right in there, it stings a little, and then it's out. Whereas people who don't have a sense of humor, it gets in there and it just does this. So I am totally envious when I have to tell a parent, you know, I think your child needs to be screened. I'm like, I wish I had a better sense of humor. It's so good for conflict. Kindness. I heard a great speaker at a funeral yesterday who was saying, when I was younger, I thought it was so important. I admire people who are clever. But now that I am older, I admire people who are kind. So kindness. If you have a child who's kind, part of you might be like, I'll make sure nobody walks all over them. Let that go. God will protect them. Celebrate their kindness. Celebrate their kindness. Gentleness. Being gentle is important. When they have moments of self-control, those might be few and far between. When they master that, let them know. I could see that you were very angry, and I saw your hand start to come up, but you did not use it to solve your problem. I'm so proud of you. Or you were so angry, and I saw that you screamed and walked away instead of using your body to solve a problem. I'm so proud of you. Because our tendency might be to be like, calm down, what's wrong with you? But that's amazing self-control, because children's emotions are very powerful, and they don't have all of the connections in their brain to be able to settle it down as quickly as we do, or we should. Courage, children who are willing to try things over and over again to do things, and you say, you know, I might have been scared to do that. We did this walk, and there's this cave, and my kids were all about going in it, and I'm terrified of rodents, so I didn't want to go in there. And they encouraged me, and finally I did it, and at the end of it, I felt really proud. And I said, you encouraged me to be brave. Thank you so much. Question askers, they're so annoying, but their potential to solve big problems is huge. So breathe and keep trying. My son and daughter are now keeping a book of questions for daddy because I get tired. So we have this book, and we'll be on Skype or in letters getting some answers. Those question askers they're really important for us in society. So I'm going to stop here, and I want to end with a video. It's a song by Jason Gray. Some of you probably know him. And I loved this video because it had my grandmother's quote in it. And every time I watch it, I think it does apply to this so much because it really celebrates a different kind of strength than the one that our culture celebrates. And I'm hoping you can start to see some of that in your children and love it and embrace it a little more. So I don't know if you know, but it's perfect for this talk. Do you know Jason Gray has a serious speech impediment? He is a massive stutter. Like, he can barely talk sometimes. So God likes to step into people's brokenness and do great things through them. So maybe your child will grow up and be famous, and we'll all get to see them, and hopefully they'll be famous for Jesus. Or maybe your child will be somebody walking through one of those doors that needs to be opened for others. And in God's economy, doing really amazing things. So thank you for having me, and I'm happy if you have time to answer questions. They can be related to this talk or generally about child development or special education.